Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Salt Lake City is set to move to the yellow coronavirus restriction level at 10 this morning. K through 12 and higher ed schools are forced to adapt after outbreaks of coronavirus, and with a September 30th deadline looming, a Utah-supported municipal nuclear power project comes under heightened scrutiny. Plus, Utah's largest police union complains about some Utah teachers saying that they are indoctrinating students. Stay tuned for all of that. On the phone for the show today, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. Good morning, Taylor.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Reporter Courtney Tanner is here as well. Hi, Courtney. Thanks for joining to you.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. And news columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning to you, Gerke.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Listeners, if you'd like to submit your questions and comments about the stories that we are covering today, we ask that you tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW, and we will try and respond to your questions on the air. I want to get to the news on schools and the challenges that are being presented by the pandemic in Utah schools. But a related story that we should get out of the way first is about Utah's capital city. And its largest city getting permission to change the coronavirus restriction level. Courtney Tanner, maybe you could just sort of sum this up for us. Salt Lake City is moving to yellow this morning. I guess what drove that decision?
Right. So Salt Lake City had been kind of the last holdout that remained in that orange restriction level. And they're moving to yellow today. And Mayor Erin Mendenhall said that she had been watching the numbers and they had gone down significantly over the last month. She also looked at some of the most impacted zip codes that includes like Rose Park and Glendale. And she'd also seen, you know, some positive signs that things were easing there. And so she requested that the governor move the city down a level to yellow.
What does it, if you can answer this, what does it practically mean in terms of, you know, precautions or what's allowed the move from orange to yellow? Is it a big difference in behavior of residents?
I think something that's important to know is that it doesn't mean that there's less risk for getting the virus, but the restrictions on like public activities do kind of ease up. So people can gather in groups of up to 50 now. Before it was 20. And all businesses can open. You know, there were some restrictions under orange on what that looked like. Restaurants can offer dine-in services. So, I mean, not huge things, but definitely kind of some easing up on stuff.
Okay. And that takes effect, again, at, I think, 10 a.m. this morning. I guess news columnist Robert Gerke, just before we turn to Courtney's education reporting, anything to say about this move to yellow from you?
Well, I mean, I think it's probably not surprising. Salt Lake City was the last jurisdiction in the state that was at orange. We've seen, and the governor also yesterday approved severe counties request to go to green. So large parts of the state are at green now. You know, I guess I keep coming back to the issue with these color coding guidelines that we have.
Right.
They can be confusing to people, as Courtney mentioned. Just because we are going from orange to yellow in Salt Lake City doesn't mean that there is less risk of infection. It just means that there are fewer restrictions. And so if the risk remains and the restrictions are lowered, there's a possibility, at least, that we could see increase in cases and then have problems on our hands again. I think maybe it would have been wise to wait a little bit longer until we saw what the impacts of the school openings were going to be, although Salt Lake City is, I think Courtney mentioned, schools are not reopening in person in Salt Lake City, so maybe less of a concern there. So it's something we'll just have to keep an eye on in the coming weeks. I think we should know in a few weeks if we see an uptick in cases and then maybe have to reconsider or reevaluate.
All right. A quick reminder to listeners that you can join us by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW, and that was Robert Gerke. Courtney Tanner, we will move on to the world of education. You know, during a pandemic, many schools at various levels are not all that far into their fall schedule, into fall classes. But because of coronavirus, some schools have had to make quick changes to how they're operating. There have been quarantines also and closures. several stories that we could jump into there. I think maybe an interesting place to start would be at Utah State University in Logan. Students in some dorms there put on lockdown, quarantined. Tell us how that happened, and then we can get to the latest on that story.
Yeah, this has been kind of an interesting situation. So Utah State and the U and BYU all kind of have worked together on this wastewater sampling, test sewage to see if there are higher levels of the coronavirus.
Right.
And so Utah State was using that in its dorm, and it noticed higher levels in four of the buildings. And so it called for the students there to be quarantined to kind of prevent an outbreak, right? To keep them in their rooms until they could figure out who had the virus and who needed to be isolated.
Okay. And that's an interesting, I'm going to just quickly plug a side story here on KCPW. Yesterday, we did a show that talked with some of the scientists who are tracking coronavirus through the sewers. And I found what these researchers had to say pretty fascinating. You can check that out at kcpw.org. So students, though, are put on lockdown as a result of determining the fact that there is the virus or the genetic material for the virus in those tests. And now some of those tests are starting to come back. What do they show, Courtney?
Yeah, so originally 287 students were quarantined. The tests are starting to come back. The university is hoping to have all of them back by the end of today, but 80% were back by yesterday, and four students out of that had tested positive.
Okay. So does that mean that students are being, let go, released from this quarantine up there?
Yeah, about half of the students have been released from quarantine. It's 29 suites. All of the roommates in a particular suite have to test negative before they're released. So some roommates may have like five results back and are waiting on a sixth. So that's kind of how the process is going.
Okay. And the context is that the Cache Health District has seen a minor spike in cases. I don't know. Do you want to fill us in on that before we move on to the picture elsewhere in Utah schools?
Right. It doesn't appear that Utah State is kind of the reason for that. Actually, the Cache County Jail has 40-plus inmates there that have now tested positive. So it seems like that might be the reason for the spike in that area of testing.
Wow. Okay. So, again, any number of directions we could go with this, the story of coronavirus in schools. Do you want to stay at the university level? I mean, is there much to be said about how things are going at other universities, public universities around the state, Courtney?
The U and BYU are going to be doing this wastewater testing, too. The U started it this week, but before they had tested all of their students before they got the key to their dorm, and they had 16 positive cases. Originally, the resident advisors there had threatened a strike, saying that the U wasn't doing enough to keep them safe. They've since come to an agreement, which is actually pretty important, and so now that has been kind of resolved.
Okay. Well, let's go to the world of K through 12 education, and of course, there are different kinds of schools to talk about here. Maybe we could talk about the different school districts for public schools. Is anyone particularly struggling, or any big changes to their fall plans now that class is in session? Or maybe what is the situation right now in Utah's K through 12 public schools, Courtney?
Yeah, so most public schools opened in the state, kind of midway through last month. And we're starting to kind of see some spread, I wouldn't say a ton of spread, but, some spread in some of these schools, and that was expected. But it's been enough for some schools to shut down. So American Preparatory Academy's Draper 1 campus, which is a K-6 campus, was shut down because they had 15 cases there among the students and the staff. That 15 threshold is actually set by the state. And they shut down and they move their classes online now. Additionally, the Utah Military Academy's campus at Camp Williams in Lehigh has also shut down. That was more of a voluntary decision. They had 9 staff members test positive, and so they moved to online as well.
Okay. And then for Utah public schools, You featured just yesterday an article that looked at a dashboard that Granite School District was developing that's tracking where coronavirus cases are. And we can talk about that, but is that something that is happening at the statewide level as well, where you're looking at how coronavirus is, or the situation of coronavirus in schools?
So the state health department has said that it's planning to release the dashboard on this, but it's still about a month away. It's just, you know, it's in development. It takes a little bit of time to get that ready. So Granite School District has created its own dashboard and published that. It shows, you know, where the cases are in its schools. You know, they said that they just want to be transparent about where the cases are and didn't want to wait for the state to finish its dashboard.
Can I ask what their dashboard shows? I mean, what is it? Are there a lot of cases?
Yeah, so it's a breakdown by school. There are 46 cases over the entire district, which is 87 schools. The highest is at Granger High School, and the dashboard shows 8 cases. This is actually kind of interesting. So the dashboard will have data every Monday. So as of this past Monday, there were 8 cases at Granger High, but since then there have been 3 more. So there's actually 11 there now, but that will be updated next Monday, and it should show kind of the little uptick there.
And then is there anything to say about other school districts around the state and how they are faring? I understand that in a number of rural counties, there's very few cases. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, the rural counties seem to be doing okay. Haven't seen any cases there in schools. Alpine School District, which is very much not rural, kind of a segue there. It's the largest in the state in Utah County, but it had some cases at Pleasant Grove High School, and it's decided to switch that to a hybrid model. It's not saying how many cases. It hasn't met the threshold to close down, but it's kind of doing this as a precaution.
How about how educators on the whole, Courtney, are feeling about the way things are happening, how districts and the state are operating during this pandemic? Is that too broad of a question to ask? I mean, obviously, there are certainly differences of opinion, but how are teachers responding to the opening of schools?
Sure. We've done some stories that have touched on this. I think that there's a lot of fear among educators. Studies have shown that educators are a little bit more at risk than their students, because of age or because of health conditions. They could face more serious complications from the virus. And so I think that there's a lot of worry and there's a lot of concern. We did a story about educators saying that they didn't have enough personal protective equipment. We did another story about educators saying that they couldn't get enough space between their desks, which had them worried about, like, social distancing. We talked to some first-year teachers as well who said, this is a really unusual year to start their careers. So I think that, obviously, there's a variance of opinions, but within Salt Lake County, at least, I think that there are some real fears among teachers.
News columnist Robert Gerke, as is often the case, I don't know exactly what to ask you here, is Utah doing the reopening of schools right, wrong? Are schools participating in a kind of experiment? Is that overstating it? What's your take, Robert Kirk?
No, I don't think that's overstating at all. I think, before schools opened, I wrote a column about how, as a parent, this is a really difficult decision because we're being expected as parents to, digest the science and the evidence that we had available, which wasn't all that great, frankly, at the time. The schools, different districts have taken different levels of precautions, and I think some are doing a better job than others at trying to ameliorate some of the risk. But I talked to a doctor for that piece several weeks ago who said this is an experiment, and it is. It remains an experiment, and we're still waiting to see the data as it rolls in. I mean, we are seeing since mid-July, I think it was, we've seen 130 plus cases linked to schools. Most of those are related to sports practices because sports practices started in mid-July. It remains an issue, and I think it remains true that young kids are less likely to get seriously ill from COVID if they contract it. Older kids are really no different from adults when it comes to spreading the disease. And so we're kind of still waiting and watching and hoping, I think, for a good outcome. Still early, and we'll just have to keep watching and see how it goes.
Hey, Robert, how about just in general on the story of coronavirus in Utah? I mean, the number of cases, we've seen a pretty, we've seen it be, you know, going down, but the percentage of positive cases hasn't necessarily been going, I mean, positive of those that are tested hasn't been necessarily going down. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, ever since, really, we started seeing this this decline shortly after Salt Lake implemented its mask mandate. We talked before about how we saw a big dip in Salt Lake, and then the rest of the state caught up shortly thereafter. In the last 2 weeks, since things bottomed out, they've kind of started going upward, particularly outside of Salt Lake County. It's not a major shift yet, but I think it's something that you need to watch in the coming week. Yesterday was the first day we had over 500 cases going back to mid-August. And that actually in mid-August, the 500-plus cases was partially due to some delayed results. And so, you know, we have some signals. We have some cause for concern here. And again, we're seeing this uptick in cases as we're easing restrictions. And it's something that we're going to have to watch. And I know that the state and county and other partners are watching carefully to see where we're going to end up going. You know, because we talked before for months of, with this virus, once you see the signals that the virus is spreading, it's you're behind the curve already because you're seeing infections that occurred days earlier in the testing. And so so we need to watch and be vigilant about this. And we also need to keep doing the things we're doing. I mean, you know, the governor talked about it yesterday. It's hard. We've been doing the social distancing for months now. We've been doing the hand washing for months now. We've been doing the masks for weeks at least. And you know, we've seen some good results from that, but it is exhausting. There's some COVID fatigue, and we're heading into a flu season, and you know, colder temperatures, people moving indoors that are more conducive to spreading the virus. So, you know, we've got to continue being careful.
Okay. And that carefulness has to happen at schools as well. Courtney, anything to say to just sort of wrap up the story of, you know, the pandemic reality at Utah schools, or anything that you want to add on that picture?
I think that probably covers schools.
Got it. Okay. Thanks very much. Courtney Tanner is an education reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. We are going to take a quick break in the show, and when we come back, we will talk about the deadline looming for a proposed nuclear power project. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporters and columnists from the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay with us.
Support for Project Resilience programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you in part by our members and USU Center for Persons with Disabilities, working to create healthy, inclusive communities through innovative research, service, technical assistance, and education. Information at cpd.usu.edu.
Next time on The Pulse, if you're a kid right now, life is nothing like it used to be.
Well, I'm not gonna lie, it's been pretty difficult.
It's been weird.
You miss your friends.
I just wanna be with them.
You even miss school.
You get to, like, do activities and fun stuff.
The impact of the pandemic on kids' lives, their health, and development.
Monday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Courtney Tanner and Taylor Stevens, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Taylor Stevens, you reported this week on the scrutiny that a nuclear power project is getting with a deadline nearing for Utah cities to say whether they want to participate. That might be getting a little ahead of things, actually. Could you tell us what the project is to start with? This is the UAMPS project.
Right. So this is the first small modular nuclear reactor in the country, and more than 20 Utah cities are participating, and it's kind of in the exploratory phase right now with plans to actually power cities that are involved by 2030, and they're participating in this through the Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems, which is a consortium of these municipalities that own their own power systems in Utah. So these cities are all over the state, from Beaver to Morgan to Parowan, Murray, Washington. But as you mentioned, they have a couple of off-ramps to decide whether they want to continue exploring this project and committing funds to it. And one of those deadlines to back out before they have to commit more money to the project is at the end of this month.
This has received a sort of preliminary approval from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which we can get to. But so there's this deadline approaching. Some cities, I understand, have already pulled out of this project, correct?
Yeah, two cities have already pulled out, and others have time if they want to. They're still kind of weighing their options. The Logan City Council voted last month to withdraw. So did the Lehigh City Council. Both city council conversations focused on the risks of the project. Like I mentioned, this is a first-of-its-kind nuclear project, so there's risks just by, new technology, trying to get it off the ground, and they feel that it shouldn't be the cities that are carrying that burden, especially some small cities. So they wanted to kind of get out. They were disappointed. They expressed disappointment because they're interested in the project. Some of these cities really see this as the future of energy, as kind of a supplement to renewables as coal is phased out. But at the end of the day, they felt it wasn't the right project for their cities and to commit their taxpayer dollars to.
And that's, on the part of the reason for that possibly is that the Utah Taxpayer Association is opposed to this project on strictly economic grounds. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so there are a couple of organizations that have been raising concerns about this project, and almost all of them, as you mentioned, are sort of talking about the financial picture. So the Utah Taxpayers Association came out against the project last month. They say they don't have a position on nuclear power, but that they don't think municipal power companies should be taking on this financial risk. They say that the risk of creating nuclear and bringing nuclear to the world shouldn't be on a few small cities in Utah and some of these other Western communities, but instead should be on venture capital investors, and that they should be taking on that financial risk because they say most nuclear projects have seen cost overruns, have seen long delays, and they feel that the rates that have been promised these municipalities are too good to be true.
Your reporting talked about how the costs of this project have been going up, and that's according to a new report that you reference. Can you just tell us about that report? And I mean, again, this is a critical look at this nuclear power project. What does the report say?
So this report actually is looking a little bit more broadly at nuclear power projects, and it found that 97% of the 180 that were examined had exceeded their budgets, an average $1.3 billion cost overrun. But you're right that this project also has had some cost overruns. Lehigh City Council gave a presentation before the council voted to withdraw. Their power director mentioned that in November 2017, the budget for this project was $3.6 billion. And by July, that had ballooned to $6.12 billion. And one thing I should mention, because I don't think we've said it yet, is that this project is planned to be built in Idaho.
Right.
So while it would power cities in Utah, and most of the cities that are involved are Utah cities, they're not building a nuclear power project in Utah. That, I think that's important to note.
Sure. It's at the Idaho National Laboratory, if I'm not mistaken. There's the environmental community has been fighting this as well. Heal Utah is worried about nuclear waste, also about, as you said, the financial concerns. Is whether or not this project happens, is that hinging on you know, this September 30th deadline and whether cities in Utah stay or go, or there being a critical mass, or, you know, or I guess what is it dependent on, Taylor?
Well, that's certainly part of it. And it's about subscription, so how many cities are subscribed. So losing cities definitely isn't good for the future of the project. However, I spoke with LeVar Webb, who is spokesman for UAMPS, the Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems. He said he hasn't heard of any other cities that are planning to leave the project. He's not terribly concerned over the exit of these two cities, especially since a Nevada municipality recently joined UAMPS. But yeah, if there's a critical mass that decides to back out ahead of the September 30th deadline, that could definitely be troublesome for the project. And, you know, this isn't the only off-ramp that these cities have. They have multiple opportunities to stop putting money into the project, and this is just one of them. And so that's why we're seeing some opposition coming up around this project now, because they want cities to get out before they put even more money into a project that they don't think is appropriate for Utah cities to be part of.
What does the project itself say about the criticism? I mean, the UAMPS project, the company, say about the fact that there are people pulling out, but also that there's, you know, this report criticizing nuclear power in general, and the costs associated with it. How are they responding to this sort of criticism?
Yeah, they stand behind the project. They really see this as the future, as I mentioned earlier, as energy in Utah. They say, you know, a safe and affordable investment for cities without coal. Oftentimes when you're talking about this project, you'll hear people say, you know, we need a reliable backload energy or baseload energy for when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing. So they're moving toward renewables, but they feel that they need some kind of baseload to provide a little bit of extra assurance, I guess, that the lights are going to come on. So they stand behind the project. They think it's going to be safe and affordable. And, you know, they say that maybe this is less about concern for these small Utah municipalities and more about just shutting down nuclear energy, which we have seen opposition to, you know, wide opposition from some environmental groups, from some other organizations that are concerned about that technology.
News columnist Robert Gerke, nuclear power. Again, as Taylor just pointed out, this is billed as addressing, diminishing coal production, for example, and, you know, keeping the lights on. But what are your thoughts here?
Well, I mean, I think this has been a debate in this country for 50 years or more, you know, whether we go toward nuclear or not. The West has been, you know, reluctant to do it. There is more nuclear power on the East Coast. You know, there's an environmental argument to be made for it, and that it is perhaps cleaner from an emissions standpoint. But there have always been these unaddressed concerns. You know, and for example, the cost concern that Taylor mentioned, I think, is valid. Either it's about $100 per megawatt hour is about, you know, almost three times what you spend for a megawatt hour of wind energy. And so there are cheaper alternatives out there that are also clean. The waste issue remains a problem. And these small reactors like this proposed project generate more waste than a large reactor. And we still don't have a solution on what to do or how to dispose of that. Can't dispose of it right now. So, you know, these are uncertainties. And I think it is a risky place for communities to be putting taxpayer dollars behind something like this when it's speculative. There are large unanswered questions lingering out there, and there are better alternatives available that we, you know, could explore more easily, more cheaply, and more efficiently.
Taylor Stevens, we're burning through the clock here, and so we're probably going to have to move on, but are we missing anything from this story?
No, I think just stay tuned. We may see a few more cities back out, but we may not. So we'll bring that information to you as we learn it.
Okay. And a reminder to listeners, tweet to us. Our handle is @KCPW to join this conversation. Taylor, I'm going to stick with you for another detailed story that you dug into this week. After an open records request, you got some information about some of the movement underway related to the Utah Inland Port. And this has to do with the development of satellite ports, actually. Actually, could you please again start with, if you don't mind, the obligatory reminder of what we're talking about? Inland ports, satellite ports, what are these things?
Sure. The satellite port concept is a way to sort of expand the idea regionally of the inland port, which is a large distribution hub for goods and kind of trying to help Utah companies get their goods to market and make it easier to import and export goods by clearing international customs. And the satellite port concept is a way to expand that vision across the state by creating some kind of other pockets where there would be port kind of development in an area. And so we have been watching the satellite port for a while, and it's been a little bit unclear exactly what the vision was. And this still, I should say, is in very early days that the port is beginning to look at this. So what they have done is they're asking Utah counties to provide information about the development picture in their community, basically pitching themselves as like, here's why I would be a good inland port location for each county. And so we put in a grandma request. We got those responses back. Really fascinating. Eight different counties, most of them rural, are hoping for a satellite port to come to their communities. They see it as a way to bring new jobs and new investment to economies that haven't seen the same benefits of our, you know, relatively good economic position over the last few years in the Wasatch Front. So they have kind of pitched themselves based on access to rail, access to air, access to interstates, all saying that they would be a good location for a distribution hub, an international kind of goods and markets location.
And then are they saying anything about what they, you know, how they would participate other than being a center of, you know, basically warehouses? What kind of industries would they be contributing, if that question makes sense?
Yeah, and it's different in each community because every community has very different, picture for what they can import and export. I thought one of the things that was interesting was in Beaver County, where they have a large livestock. Smithfield has a large warehouse isn't the right word, but a large facility where they have chickens and turkeys and I think, you know, cows. They see this as a way to help export livestock as well as hay. So it really depends on which location of the state. It's actually a hog farm. Sorry.
Yeah.
They have a hog farm there that they see this as a way to help, you know, with the livestock transport. Other parts of the state are talking specifically about coal. So two of the communities mentioned coal in their proposals. That's Emery County and Iron County. And that's a big concern for environmentalists who have been opposed to this project because they have been concerned throughout that the satellite ports would be used as a way to transfer coal throughout the state and prop up what they see as a dying industry.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, an interesting part of that. That's so a lot of these counties that are trying to do this, they're looking at the port as a kind of, you know, panacea. They something to stop their economic atrophy, and you've got a pandemic that's playing into that. But port opponents, people who don't want to see the port happen at all, they were formed by the documents that you dug up. Some of that had to do with specifically the fact that fossil fuels were part of it, but also they were alarmed by the fact that these documents existed because they had. Can you tell us that part of the story, Taylor?
Sure. And, you know, we talked about the inland port on the show before, and the needs of the port were shrouded in some secrecy, a lack of transparency, and those accusations have dogged the inland port to date. And so they as you mentioned, that they hadn't seen any of this information, that they weren't aware of it. They were kind of had an eye on the process in Sevier County, which was unfolding through a public process. And Sevier County actually didn't end up in an application. They decided that, you know, other communities had better access to rail and that they weren't kind of the right fit for this at this time. So they were alarmed to learn. I asked the Inland Port about this, and they said early that they're doing their homework. They're trying to get a sense of what's out there. The community has put in an application. Doesn't mean a satellite port is needed there, they mentioned. So they're kind of on this first phase of trying to understand what the picture is, and they say that that be seen as a lack of transparency, that that should be seen as a public entity that is work. I will say, you know, this project has the power to really remake the state as we know it, and that's why I think that, you know, as the Salt Lake Tribune, that we've been doing some extra scrutiny of what's going on behind the scenes and trying to kind of let people know every twist and turn of how this is moving forward.
One of those twists and turns that opponents also singled out, port opponents like Dita Seed singled out, was the proposal to use public lands to build a satellite port and then to move fossil fuels, coal again. I can't remember which county that was in.
That's in Emery County.
Emery County. Maybe, you know what, maybe I'll bring Robert Gerke in, news columnist, for a moment. So hold tight, though we will have to wrap this up shortly as well. But news columnist Robert Gerke, port opponents, you know, talking about this being secretive. There's also the public lands angle that I just brought up. And then you have the counties that are seeming to clamor for this. What do you think about the process and about the plans that Taylor is describing and how this is unfolding?
I mean, frankly, I actually kind of like the idea of the satellite port because I think you have some of the advantages. Some of these proposals have some of the same advantages that the proponents of the port were espousing, sort of this juncture of major interstates and rail. And it could be potential economic development opportunity for rural parts of the state that need the economic development help. And so, I think, and you have fewer traffic concerns. That was a big concern here is the truck traffic that you would see in the Salt Lake Valley would spike under the port proposal. So, I mean, I think it's worth exploring, but I think it's worth exploring the right way. I think it shouldn't have taken Taylor, digging into this to the extent that she did to break through that sort of opacity of it that we've seen throughout the port process. I mean, this needs to be transparent and there needs to be buy-in. And it can't just be the port dealing with, local leaders. They need buy-in from the public on this. And when it's not transparent, it breeds suspicion. And so, they could do a better job of doing it the right way. And I think that would, maybe alleviate some of these concerns. But I think it's an opportunity that's worth exploring because there is some upside and probably less downside than with the existing sort of Salt Lake port proposal.
Taylor Stevens, if you had to summarize where we currently are on the Salt Lake port proposal, you know, what would you say? Like, how where are we in this process?
So the last meeting that we had centered around the business plan, which provided some information about how port leaders see the project moving forward. But we are kind of in a spot where we're waiting to see what's going to happen next, trying to just to figure out where all of this is headed. So I would say that we're still kind of in the early phases of the project and just seeing where it goes at this point.
Okay. You know what? We're going to have to leave it there. Last week, we touched on the fact that port opponents had written to Rio Tinto Kennecott to try and get them involved in not developing land in the northwest quadrant of Salt Lake City. You can check that out at kcpw.org. We're going to head to another break here in the show. Taylor Stevens, thanks very much for your reporting on this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. And when we come back, we will turn to complaints by a police union about Utah teachers. Again, this is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, back in a moment.
Utah Public Radio programming is supported by our members and Idaho National Laboratory. INL researchers recently supported NASA's launch of the Mars Perseverance rover on a 7-month journey to the Red Planet. More information about INL's role is available at inl.gov.
In times of uncertainty, conversation can be a sustaining light. I'm Helga Davis, and on my show, I have inspiring conversations with people you may recognize, like the host of On Being, Krista Tippett, and Grammy Award-winning bassist, Esperanza Spalding. Join me for a special broadcast of Helga.
Tune in for part four of this five-part series beginning at 10 o'clock this morning here on Utah Public Radio.
I ain't gonna have you guys all on that day. I said, Rock, what's the matter with you, Rock? Don't you see I need you, Rock?
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Stevens, Courtney Tanner, and Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. And you can weigh in on what you've been hearing by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And returning now to Courtney Tanner. Courtney, the state's largest police union says that children in the state are being, quote unquote, indoctrinated by teachers or by some teachers. Basically, this is, part of the broader picture of protests, calls for police reform and activism that we have been seeing. Maybe you could just guide us through this. The Utah Fraternal Order of Police sent a letter to the state superintendent of schools with this complaint. Tell us what that letter said.
Yeah, so the Order of Police here sent this letter, like you said, to the State Board of Education, and they alleged that teachers in the state are pushing an anti-law enforcement agenda. They specifically say that teachers are making disparaging comments about officers in front of students. And also they point out that some teachers have been wearing Black Lives Matter shirts in the classroom.
So are they asking for teachers, to sort of not talk about this topic or to obviously, I guess, not wear Black Lives Matter shirts? Is there a specific demand?
Yeah, they say, educators should be neutral on political issues. So they are kind of painting this as a political issue. And I think that kind of depends on who you ask. The Black Lives Matter Utah chapter says, this isn't political. This is about our lives. But they're asking for teachers to not be able to make kind of, quote, political statements. The law already says, that teachers can't do that. What's fuzzy is if wearing a T-shirt for the BLM movement kind of crosses that or not. So it's an interesting debate.
And again, you said you spoke with the founder of Black Lives Matter Utah, Lex Scott, and she, in your article, she says she wants to sit down with the police union. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, she was pretty calm, I guess, about the issue. She said that valuing Black lives isn't partisan, but she said she wanted to talk to the union and sit down with leaders and try to discuss their concerns and a way to move forward.
And I guess, yeah, right. There's one part of it is the T-shirt itself, the idea of wearing a Black Lives Matter T-shirt. And for the police union, that very act seems to be, to them, demonizing police. Did Lex Scott respond to that idea?
Yeah, I mean, she said, that it's not a political statement, that it's just a statement of, that a Black life is important. Some people have compared it to like having a rainbow sticker in a classroom for like the LGBT community, kind of akin to just saying that these people are important.
I want to bring in news columnist Robert Gerke on this. And Gerke, there's something kind of representative about this story. And it's also hard not to think about another story, one that Peyton Harkins reported just last night of a protest against Tribune editorial cartoonist Pat Bagley for drawing this cartoon that decries white supremacy, specifically white supremacy in law enforcement. And maybe they're not exactly related stories, but do you want to tackle the story that Courtney reported on? And then maybe we can go to that other story before we wrap up the show. The police union worried about indoctrination of students.
Well, I mean, I think like everything in our country these days, it's being polarized and politicized in a way that's unfortunate. I mean, I can see where these teachers are coming from. They have minority students in their classes and want to express support for those minority students. you know, and that is taken and turned into a derogatory statement toward police. And I don't, you know, whether or not that's the intent, that's the way it seemed, because we're in these times where two people can look at the same set of facts and come to radically different conclusions, right?
Right.
So, you know, there's always been a little bit of peril, I guess, in teachers expressing opinions on these sort of these difficult topics, these political topics in some ways. And so they probably do need to be careful, but I also think that it's appropriate, entirely appropriate, for them to show support for their minority students in their classes, or the black students in their classes, and make sure that it's a place where they feel comfortable. At the same time, I think this arose, if I'm not mistaken, by a child of a police officer who felt like it was being derogatory toward his or her parents. And so, you know, there's got to be a sensitivity and caution in that respect, too. It's you know, hopefully, one would hope, I guess, that we can get to a point where expressing support for a group of people is not seen as demeaning another group of people, but that's where we are right now, unfortunately.
Hmm. Taylor, Robert brought up the fact that that there was a one student who, where this arose from, the student who was the child of a law enforcement officer. Can you tell us that part of the story?
Courtney, student,
I think I said Taylor. Yeah, go ahead.
You're right. One student in the classroom was the daughter of an officer. The union says that the officer was injured during one of the recent Salt Lake City rallies. And they say that this student, you know, felt like her parent was being attacked in the classroom.
Okay. And then, Gerke, you know, you talked about the fact that we are talking past each other, that people, you know, expressing support for one group is is interpreted as being opposition to another group. And this doesn't really exactly fall into that, but there is that the Pat Bagley cartoon about white supremacy in law enforcement, and then the protest that happened last night in front of the Tribune printing, you know, the presses, I guess. It was a Back the Blue, Boycott the Salt Lake Tribune protest, which happened after the Utah Sheriff's Association and the leader of a group called Utah Business Revival complained about this cartoon. I mean, I don't know. I guess we should probably describe the cartoon. It's a picture of a police officer at a doctor's office, and in the X-ray is an image of a white supremacist in the body of the person. And I can't remember what the caption says, but it says, "Oh, there's your problem. You know, you've got
there's
white supremacy."
Problem.
So this is being seen as an attack on law enforcement by some, but by others, it's like, look, this is a problem you have to deal with inside of law enforcement. Was his cartoon being misinterpreted?
Well, I mean, I think I go back again to two different people looking at the same set of facts and coming to radically different conclusions. I mean, Pat has said, and I take him at his word, that, you know, he wasn't suggesting that all law enforcement is racist. I think all of us know police officers and know quite a few police officers who we would not consider to be racist, right? So I think it would be so I think that was not the intent, is to portray them all as racist, but there are racist police officers, just like there are racist firefighters, racist school teachers. You know, you can run down the list of any profession. Right. Any profession has racists. I think when you're talking about police officers, more power that can be exercised by a police officer in a fairly arbitrary manner. And so it's important that issue be discussed. The response has been predictable. When I saw that cartoon, I knew that Pat was going to catch hell for it, and he has. And again, we're now at a point where we're talking past each other and not talking about the real issue, and that is, how do we make sure that our police forces are using that, you know, that power, that considerable power that they're given, in an effective and impartial way. And so, you know, maybe if at the end of the day we have a discussion about this, I think the Salt Lake City mayor has been having discussions about, you know, racial justice and policing for the last
right.
8 weeks, you know. But, you know, this is again, a symptom of our politicized climate and the fact that we now talk past each other and I guess see what we want to see in something.
Boy. Well, it's a daunting reality to be a part of. With that, though, I'm afraid we're going to have to turn now to our final segment of the show. Courtney Tanner, thanks for reporting that story, by the way. But the underplayed stories of the week, and let's go back to Taylor Stevens to start. Taylor, do you have a pick for underplayed story?
Yeah, I was going to call out Peyton's reporting from last night. It's always difficult when, as a reporter, your news outlet has become the story, but I think she covered it in a way that was fair and balanced and gave voice to those who were dissenting. So great work from her, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it must be bizarre to go and identify yourself as a Salt Lake Tribune reporter when the protesters are protesting the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, I think it kind of combines two, but there's yesterday the governor announced CDC was going to be sending 150 million rapid test kits to Utah. These rapid test kits are sort of the future of COVID testing, and you can get results in 15 minutes. We're kind of trying to push in that direction so you can do more frequent and more real-time testing. And at the same time, the Pac-12 conference has signed a contract to do testing of its athletes using these rapid tests, which, you know, while the Pac-12 has said they're not going to resume sports until January, the president of the league said, or the president of the conference, I rather, said that this could maybe change that equation a little bit. So these rapid tests are sort of our future weapon against COVID, and I think it's something to watch.
All right, great picks from Robert Gerke for Underplayed Story of the Week. Courtney Tanner, we will turn to you now. What's your pick?
I'm going to pick a really lighthearted story by Larissa Beth Turner. She did this really fun piece on soft-serve ice cream shops popping up around Salt Lake County, and the pictures are just totally making me drool, so check that out.
Okay, check that out at sltrib.com. For my part, I'm going to go actually with a story not in the Salt Lake Tribune. I'll go with a not underplayed story, but the story written and published by the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine. It details some pretty damning statements by the president of the United States about veterans and members of the U.S. military. You know, the article is by Jeffrey Goldberg, who is no lightweight journalist. The president says that it's fake news, but again, it's tough to discount when you look at where it's coming from. That is my pick for underplayed story of the week. Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens, Courtney Tanner, and columnist Robert Gerke, thanks very much for joining me today on Behind the Headlines.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
And that does it for Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And you can find all of the reporting, or almost all of the reporting we've been talking about today, at sltrib.com. Join us again next week for more conversations about Utah news. And until then, I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
Calling all artists, designers, bird and native plant lovers. The deadline for the Utah Public Radio and Bridgerland Audubon Society Grow Native for Birds Bookmark Art Contest has been extended. You now have until October 13th to submit your best design celebrating the beauty of Utah's native plants and the many wild birds that rely on them. Your vote will decide the winning design and it will be printed on an educational bookmark. For more details, go to upr.org, and to submit, just send your design to katie.swain@usu.edu.
A service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, this is Utah Public Radio. Heard statewide on KUSR, Logan, KUSK, Vernal, KUSL, Richfield, KUST, Moab, KCEU, Price, and KUSU-FM, Logan.
Coming up next on Utah Public Radio, it is Helga from WNYC. WNYC programming on UPR is made possible by USU's Center for Intersectional Gender Studies and Research, challenging inequality through inclusive teaching and research. Information on scholarships, fellowships, and programming at intersections.usu.edu.